Good morning. It's Tuesday, September 9th from HPR2. It's The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Lynn Waters, sitting in this week while Beth Ann's away.
The Environmental Protection Agency has the results of a new study of Tern Island and the threatened environment of the Northern Pacific. We'll talk with the regional administrator, Jared Blumenfeld.
How the face of elder care is transforming in the face of changing economic realities. We'll talk with Dr. Kuhio Asam of Lunalilo Home.
And we'll hear why many educators want you to vote yes on ballot initiative number 4, which opens the door to state funding of preschool education. Deborah Zeisman, executive director of Good Beginnings Alliance, is here.
And how a group of artists is building a creative nest in Kaka'ako. We'll hear from Sally Lundberg about the present project.
Stay here for The Conversation, but next, the news.
Welcome back to The Conversation. I'm Lynn Waters, sitting in this week with my good friend, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Lynn. We're having a good time, aren't we?
I'm happy to be here.
I've been enjoying this. The remote islands to the north and west of Hawaii and the ocean that surrounds them offer some stunning examples of nature's abundance in a vast, relatively unpopulated corner of the earth. If only that were the whole story. The area is also home to the infamous Pacific Garbage Patch, where plastic bags, fishnets, and industrial chemicals we discard collect in an ugly mass. It collects on the beaches of Tern Island, where migratory seabirds also gather, and that's why a new Environmental Protection Agency study of the island, 550 miles to the northwest, is especially valuable. Jared Blumenfeld has been the regional administrator for the EPA Pacific Southwest region since 2009. He joins us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris. Good morning, Lynn. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
Good.
Jared, what can we learn from this latest information? Does it build on what we already know? Are there some new data coming in?
So sitting here in Honolulu, it seems a long, long way away to the French frigate shoals. But this island, Tern Island, was identified actually by an environmental group, Center for Biological Diversity, asked us, EPA, to do under Superfund, which is used to clean up the worst of the worst sites, can we do an assessment to determine what's happening here? And as you mentioned, it's home to really very rare endangered species, the Hawaiian green sea turtle. 95% of all of them left in the world are in French frigate shoals in Tern Island. And the Hawaiian monk seal, of which there's only a few thousand left, the most endangered marine mammal in the world, also is there. So we did two things. One, we looked at, is there a problem that needs to be cleaned up? And secondly, this question that you asked, which is, how do plastics, very small plastics, gather the toxins, especially things like PCBs, and move them up the food chain into monk seals? And is that part of the problem of why monk seals are not surviving at the moment?
Very likely that it would be, right?
We don't know. It's very far away. We've got all kinds of great offers from help. The Army National Guard here in Hawaii said, we'll do anything we can. We'll bring our equipment. We'll do this as a training. What we found out through this study, and it was a very exhaustive study, really is the magnitude of the problem. The Navy was there. The Coast Guard was there up until 1979, and they left a lot of things, batteries, all kinds of contaminants like PCBs that shouldn't be on an island in a pristine area of the world. So this is a very special part of Hawaii, but it's also the convergence of all the ocean currents. So unfortunately, it attracts marine mammals and seabirds. It also attracts a lot of plastics.
And it really should be one of the world's pristine areas. But in a way, the fact that it is remote and so unpopulated makes it possible for us to kind of detach from the impact of throwing away those plastic bags, yeah?
It does, and at the same time, if it is polluted, it really speaks volumes about the rest of the planet. So we want to do our best with our partner, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, to think about what are the next steps? How can we take care of this special place? And unfortunately, with sea level rise, many of the parts of the French frigate shoals are expected to go underwater. This is one of the few that will remain, and so it's even more important as a sanctuary for all these species that rely on it.
What's an approximate timeline for the sea level rise to make that change? 30 years?
I think people are saying between 50 and 100 years, but that's really a blink of an eye in the terms of evolution and thinking about these animals.
In geologic time, it's
right.
Racing along.
Yes, it is. It's happening quickly, and it really requires us to double up and really focus as much attention as we can on this special part of the world. And people that come to Hawaii probably never get the chance to go here, or this is exactly halfway between Hawaii and Midway. It's kind of quarter way.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't get to go there, but many, many endangered species do. It has beautiful coral that a whole ecosystem is reliant upon. And it's very damaged from years and years of pollution. And now we're starting to see this link between plastics. It's incredible. If you take a piece of plastic and measure how much pollution is on it, and then you put it in the ocean, literally those toxins go from miles and miles away to that piece of plastic. It's like a magnet in the ocean for toxins. And then they're so small that animals think that they're things that they eat. They mimic all the kinds of life forms in the ocean. And so they bioaccumulate, and then we find in monk seals that they have very high levels of PCB.
In the post-war years when plastics were being rapidly introduced and the world of science pretty much was all the way behind them, new miracle materials that are going to allow us to do all kinds of things, there wasn't much attention to those long-term consequences, was there?
No. I think that's true of many things, from lead to asbestos to PCBs. We developed them, and we didn't really understand their long-term consequences, DDT in eggshells. We do now have that knowledge.
Are we now acting on that knowledge just generally?
Slowly but surely.
But you know what I'm saying. That has there been that change of consciousness, really, in the world of scientific research?
Later on this afternoon, I'm talking to Kim Johnson, and she's got this great group of kids. At the kids' level, they're starting to be conscious of it.
Yeah.
And they ask the question, why aren't we doing more to help solve these problems?
In a way, that's really a ray of hope, isn't it? Because they're going to be expecting that as they grow into voting age. They're going to really define things.
I have a 13 and a 15-year-old, and they ask me to stop talking about all the environmental horrors that I see every day. They're like, Dad, it's just too depressing. So what this really offers is a ray of hope. That's what I think people need to see, that if they do the hard work, we can turn this around and turn this place that has been despoiled back into a sanctuary.
In a way, that it's too depressing state of mind. I mean, that's pervasive, because just when you contemplate the size of the so-called garbage patch,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's beyond what most people could imagine, and yet none of us have seen it.
It's true. I mean, even today, I was just across the street getting my breakfast, and I asked them where I can recycle the can, even though you get 5 cents, and they said, oh, just throw it away. So we all can do our bit to think that little teeny step, and that's what I think. These problems are so big that people get overwhelmed and then they stop acting. So we need to show them that the little things that you can do every single day can make a world of difference.
In a way, is it helpful to focus on a relatively, you know, in an isolated, a sample area like Tern Island?
No, that's a great point, Chris. So originally the group asked us to do the whole Northwest Hawaiian Islands, which was just much too big for us to be able to handle. And logistically too complicated to study. So little bits that we can focus on, people can understand how they can help. People want to help. That's the one thing that you see anywhere you go. If you show them a problem that can be solved, they'll say, we're in, tell us how we can help.
Trouble is they have to see it, and the fact that so few have seen what's happening there, that has an effect too, doesn't it?
It doesn't. I mean, I think, you know, we're very good at seeing things, and I spoke to one of the artists that's coming on next. You know, people can visualize and understand that there's pristine places that they're never going to go. that they want to keep pristine, even if they never do go there. Yeah. I think it's true of the rainforest and Antarctica, and those are places I've never been, but I want to know that they stay pristine, and Tern Island is one of those that unfortunately needs our help now.
It really feels as if that change of consciousness might well be happening in time.
Yeah, and many people think this is the epicenter, Hawaii. People think, you know, and I think every time I come here, I'm shocked by you're very close to nature. People come here for a lifestyle that involves being outdoors and close to the ocean and the mountains. And so hopefully we can tap into that and get Tern Island cleaned up.
I think the energy's there. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Lynn.
Jared Blumenfeld has been the regional administrator for the EPA Pacific Southwest region since 2009. And you can learn more about his work at hpr2.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:16, and later in the show, a new perspective on care for the elderly. But first, your quiz.
Later this month, Honolulu will host the 9th annual Improvaganza, Hawaii Festival of Improv. With that in mind, we're focusing on improv for our backyard quiz today. So, Loose Screws, a long-running but now disbanded island-based theater group, has put on a wide range of shows, such as sci-fi-themed series, Spaced, the Power Rangers-inspired J-pop show, Harajuku All-Girl Ninja Force. Sound familiar? To many, though, the group is most well-known for its unique improvised kabuki performance, Screwbuki. Though the format is lighthearted and comedic, the performance always utilizes traditional movements, vocal styling, combat, and music to create an entirely improvised kabuki play. Originally performed in 2000 with a local cast including Rob Bunnell, Chris Doy, R. Kevin Garcia Doyle, and Sean T.C. O'Malley, Screwbuki garnered national attention and was eventually invited to perform at a prestigious improv festival on the mainland. For today's backyard quiz, we're wondering if you can tell us the name of this mainland improv festival. If you know the answer, give us a call at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Otherwise, we'll be back with it in the next half hour.
Aloha, this is jazz singer Sasha Boutros. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Find out more about the show at hpr2.org.
One thing in life is certain, we are all getting older. We've all read recently that the senior population is growing and will continue to grow. So how can we ensure that the cost of their kupuna care stays within reason and that we maintain their quality of life? Tough questions. Dr. Kuhio Asam is the executive director of King Lunalilo Home. He is with us this morning to help answer some of them. Good morning, Kuhio.
Good morning and aloha. Aloha from the kupuna at Lunalilo Home as well.
thank you for taking the time to be with us this morning. You know, a lot of us know of Lunalilo Home. We've had relatives that stayed there, or we're certainly aware of it as an Ali'i Trust. But can you tell us in general, for those who don't know, what it is and why it exists?
Oh, I'd be glad to, and thanks for asking. Lunalilo Home is what is called an ARCH, an adult residential care home. And in the spectrum of care for our kupuna, it sits somewhere between skilled nursing and assisted living. So we actually service those kupuna who really aren't able to fully independently live safely in their homes. And what we provide is that environment of support and monitoring in order that they can have a quality lifestyle, somewhat like the assisted living. With that, we can actually serve a number of people with a number of different needs.
So I guess when we think of the old saying, nothing is certain in life except death and taxes, we should probably add aging to that as well, because that is certain now.
It's certain, and isn't it wonderful? I mean, we consider our kupuna at Lunalilo Home as our treasures, and the place itself is their home.
Did you think when you were young that you would be working in an industry where older people were, where people were just living longer in general? We are in general living longer than previous generations.
It's amazing the number of people who, as they advance in their age, actually can become and are active and vibrant. And I think a lot of people forget about that. So it's wonderful to work in a place where there's an environment in which there's activities and spirited, healthy lifestyles. And that's what we do.
So it's not just about being alive. It's being alive and still living, I guess, maybe.
Oh, certainly. Not only living, but actually enjoying and being able to contribute as well. A number of programs that are in existence actually combine the younger generation with the older generation, and therefore there's intergenerational learning. And those are the wonderful things that we can actually celebrate.
How many, give us an idea of the size of the home. How many residents do you have right now? Are you full?
We are basically full most of the time. We have a capacity of 41 persons. Mm-hmm. We are licensed by the Department of Health, who actually come by twice a year to do surveys to assure that we are providing the quality of care. Mm-hmm. The 41 residents that we have enjoy different kinds of accommodations, from private rooms to shared rooms with or without bath. Yeah, it's a wonderful place. The history of Lunalilo Home goes back 130 years. Founded by King Lunalilo through his will, he left his funds in order to support Hawaiians who were financially needy, mm-hmm. And who required care. So today, we still offer subsidies for those Hawaiians who can't afford to be there. But what a lot of people don't know is that we actually have a number of persons of other ethnicities, non-Hawaiian, who are also there. And that truly makes a wonderful multicultural community, very similar to that which we all live in.
And you use the term ARCH, Adult Residential Care Home. Can you tell me a little more specifically what that means?
Sure. Almost self-explanatory in terms of adult, mm-hmm. residential care home. Most of the care homes in the islands, as you may know, are in the community, where there are four to seven or so persons in a private home. Mm-hmm. Those are all arches, but we are one of those that are larger, which allows us to expand and give a lot more opportunities for the residents that we have.
And how does that fit into the overall continuum of care from the time a person, say, retires and then is unable to stay in their own home until ultimately passing away?
Sure. We talk about the vertical progression of potential care. And there are many seniors who actually live independently. So independent living is optimal. Then there is adult daycare for those who actually can still live in a home setting in the community, but maybe need a little bit more during the day. So Lunalilo Home actually offers a day
So you
program.
Have daycare programs?
Daycare program, 6:30 in the morning till 6:30 in the evening, two meals a day, activities, singing, All of those things. So those are for persons who can still stay in their home but perhaps need a bit more monitoring during the day.
Is there a limit to the number that you can accommodate in that program?
There is a limit, and we are full.
You're full.
But certainly things change on a weekly basis, so we welcome people to come in and find out more about our day program as well as our residential. To continue on the continuum, after persons are unable to live at home alone, and then there's assisted living, and then adult residential care home, and then skilled nursing. So we're nestled right, as I mentioned, between assisted living and skilled nursing.
Can someone come tour the facility if they maybe are interested in having their parents stay there or they themselves eventually?
We would certainly welcome all people to come and visit us. There's so many people who travel up and down Luna Lila Home Road daily. But don't know
well-traveled road.
Well-traveled road, and we're actually nestled in the community on the slopes of Cocoa Head. So I would suggest that people go to our website, www.lunalilo.org. That's, again, www.lunalilo.org. Take a look at what we have to offer. Give us a call, set up an appointment to come on in, and what you see in terms of the images on the website will be transformed to knowing the warmth and compassion that we have for our kupuna, our treasures.
I have been to your luau before, more than once. It's a wonderful place and a wonderful event.
It's a joyous, vivacious, active place. It's wonderful.
Now, on a more general level, what do you think people should know about preparing for their own senior years, or what would you like the general public to be left with this morning?
It's extremely important to start the conversation early in adult life regarding yourselves, as well as one approaches what we call kupuna stage. It's all too often we see those who are faced with having to make a decision at a time of crisis rather than having it planned. So start the conversation early, talk to your kids, talk to your spouse, your family, and make some plans.
Wise words from Dr. Kuhio Asem, Executive Director of the King Luna Lilo Home. Thank you for coming in today. Luna Lilo is a residential care home for the elderly established by the will of King Luna Lilo. You can find out more at hpr2.org.
Aloha and thank you.
If you enjoyed Aloha Shorts, the program of local literature, actors, and musicians, then you won't want to miss the live taping of From Me to You. The September 13th performance is sold out, but good news, a second show has been added on Friday, September 12th. That's From Me to You, hosted and with music by John Osorio in the Atherton, September 12th at 7:30. Tickets at hprtickets.org or 955-8821 during business hours.
Here at Hawaii Public Radio, we're dedicated to bringing you more excellent radio and less on-air fundraising. Early giving for Celebration 2014 can help us return to programming within the allotted days, maybe earlier. We gratefully acknowledge Colleen and Keith Tester of Kihei, Leanne Briggs of Kaneohe, and Susan Hicks of Keao. Thank you for your early gifts for Celebration 2014. Now it's your turn. New members frequently join at the $10 a month True Believer level. Click on the support link at hpr2.org. Hawaii legalized medical marijuana 14 years ago, but has yet to provide patients with a way of getting their medicine. That may be changing. Civil Beat's Chad Blair has the story in today's Reality Check. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Chris.
That 14-year gap between passage of a bill and implementation of a bill, it's
It's Hawaii for you.
Yeah, you know the old expression, smoke them if you got them. But if you don't got them, you're not going to be able to smoke them. You know, this is a serious matter. We were one of the first states to legalize medical marijuana. I think California was first in 1996, and we came along in 2000. So, yeah, it's been 14 years. Today, 23 states now allow medical marijuana. But Hawaii, we're one of only five states that do not have a dispensary system in place, medical marijuana dispensaries that allow a patient who qualifies to go in and get their medicine. And that's something that the legislature is looking at changing.
What are the what would be the first steps? Dare I say they're going to do a study?
Well, they actually have done a study. The Legislative Reference Bureau does a pretty thorough study looking at what other states' practices are and comparing them to Hawaii. Interestingly enough, it's titled, Is the Grass Always Greener? And the short answer to the question is, yeah, it appears that other states have made a greater progress in setting up dispensaries and finding ways to help people that need it. So the study's done. There's going to be a briefing on that study this morning at the Capitol. There's a task force that will then submit proposals for legislation for next session.
Well, at least the study is behind us because, Chad, as
yes.
you know, when you start hearing words like study and task force, you go, oh, no, you know, and you see delay in the future. But this sounds as if it's fairly close to implementation.
But there's a lot of cautionary notes here. The biggest opposition to medical marijuana being set up at all has been from law enforcement, particularly from the police departments and the prosecuting attorneys. And their arguments, well, there's several, but basically they center around this one, that marijuana is illegal at the federal level. It's a Schedule I drug. They feel that there's still a lot of debate over the science as to whether medical marijuana is actually helpful or harmful. And so they have been a huge obstacle towards changing the law. And you can bet they're going to be staying active and getting their view across to the task force. You know, there was a couple of bills last session to look at dispensaries. They went nowhere.
Well, there's certainly been that kind of opposition from law enforcement in the states that are a lot farther along than Hawaii as well, right?
Right. And the idea, as Della Albalotti, the representative that's on the task force, and she's kind of spearheading this, she said the idea is to look for best practices. What have other states done in order to accommodate this? So I think we are going to be hearing a lot about this. By the way, there's public hearings tomorrow on Oahu. And then later in Hilo, I think, or rather it's in Hilo tomorrow on Oahu later this month, the public can turn out and share their manao on this issue.
It does seem as if this is gaining momentum, don't you think, Chad?
I think so, too. There is a nationwide trend, and that's something that the study indicated as well. So there's a sense that the tide is turning on this regard. These are people that are sick, that qualify for help. Let's help them.
It'd be a good story to follow. Thanks very much, Chad. Chad
Thanks,
Blair
Chris.
Is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com. Should preschool education be publicly funded? Educators have no doubt about its value, but who should pay for it? The cost is prohibitive for many parents, but the cost of passing up early education could be far greater for students, parents, and society. There's a ballot initiative this November that asks voters to consider funding a statewide preschool system. Deborah Zaisman of the Good Beginnings Alliance wants us to vote yes on ballot question number 4, and she's with us this morning to explain why.
Good morning. Well,
good morning, Deborah. You know, first of all, studies have been flowing in for years about the starting earlier with education, correct?
Correct. The evidence is so sound. We know that 90% of a child's brain development happens before the age of 5, that those early years are incredibly formative. We really need to give children opportunities before they get to formal education in kindergarten.
The impression I get that is a lot of fundamental tendencies are formed then. I mean, I'm talking about intellectual curiosity, creativity, really core things about the brain, right?
Yeah, I think we could all think back on our own formative experiences and how much those things shape us for the rest of our life. And then the science bears it out. We know children who have access to early education perform better on reading scores at fourth grade. They're substantially more likely to graduate from high school, and so on and so on. So it's sort of, it's those building blocks that are so important. And I think those of us, I'm sure you can think back on those early years and what influenced you.
Well, I certainly remember it as a time when everything was pretty wonderful.
Yep.
You know, early childhood, everything was amazing, and your curiosity and the things that are later going to make you into an artist, a mathematician, a scientist, whatever, are kind of people who know you well will say, oh, you were just like that when you were 4 years old.
Exactly. And I think these days, kindergarten is not what it used to be either. The expectations are fairly high, given everything going mm-hmm. on in the world. And unfortunately, in Hawaii, we still see that 42% of our kids are starting kindergarten with no early education. So our goal is to substantially fix that. We're hoping by 2018 to have 85% of our kids in Hawaii having some access to preschool before they begin kindergarten.
How far away are we from that now?
Well, we're only in the 50s, depending on where in the state we are, 50%. So we have a ways to go. The average across the state is that 42% of children don't get any preschool education.
In that percent that do, that includes the parents who are paying for it.
Really, that's the bulk of it right now. So we know parents know what you just said, that early education is key. And so parents and families who can afford it and make sacrifices and write the tuition checks do so. Unfortunately, lower and middle income children often don't get that access because it's very expensive. Many schools, it's $800 per month per child.
One of the ironies of the contemporary educational system is that education has struggled for a couple of centuries not to be class-based
mm-hmm.
and not to favor those of certain birth, economic status, et cetera. This is moving in the wrong direction, isn't it?
If
you have to be able to pay for it.
And we know that access to early education will actually help improve our K-12 system, that what we see now is huge gaps between our kids. Those who come in having access to pre-K are miles ahead of their peers who have not. And we want to reduce those gaps. We want to have all kids starting school on more equal footing.
Well, Deb, let's talk about the mechanism for doing that then. And this, the ballot initiative asks us to empower the legislature to create a mechanism. Is that right?
Correct. So the only thing this ballot initiative will do will allow the state to contract with community-based preschool providers. That's what it will do. We're unique. We're the only state that we are aware of that has this prohibition in our state constitution that says the funding can only stay within the state. So we're really working on those public-private partnerships, which we see elsewhere, that community-based preschools can deliver high-quality services to our kids and get them ready for school.
Are there states that have a mechanism similar to what you're asking for in place now?
All of them. Unfortunately, we are unique. We're the only state that we've come across that has this prohibition. So
I see.
There are about 40 other states that are doing what we're talking about doing, delivering high-quality pre-K to as many 4-year-olds as possible.
And they're doing it by funding nonprofits, not by creating a mechanism themselves.
There's a combination, and that's actually what we're looking at here in Hawaii. We feel that some of the services should be provided by our Department of Education within DOE classrooms. Others perhaps might be on a DOE campus, but done by a nonprofit provider, and some will be out in the community. So again, this also allows the state to contract money out and ensure that there's quality metrics in place. We want to make sure that what's done is of the highest quality possible, that we see outcomes for our kids.
The decision about contracting out, is that under the purview of the DOE?
Do you mean and how to contract it?
Yeah, who implements this mechanism of finding the nonprofits?
That will be up to the legislature and the new administration to decide. So this measure that we're talking about in November, voting yes on question 4, just opens up options. It gives options to the legislature, to the next governor and his staff. We don't know. It could be a number of different models, and we've been providing those examples. The issue is if the measure does not pass, we can only build a system within the State Department of Education.
And the State Department of Education has probably got more than enough to do with its existing budget already, right?
I mean, well,
would be asking a lot.
They do, and we think they should have some role, but not the only role. So mm-hmm. we're very happy to see. We advocated last year for funding to start 18 pilot preschools on DOE campuses. Those just started a month ago. From what we've heard, they're going really well. They're in low-income Title I communities. We'd like to see more than 18. But again, we have 17,000 students to provide for. Those 18 classrooms provide services for 420 kids. So we are concerned that if we only are building within DOE, it's going to be very slow. It's going to be very costly. My grandkids perhaps will be the ones benefiting, not my children.
Because it'll put pressure on an already overburdened
right.
Administrative.
There's not facilities. Yeah. There's not, the capacity. Whereas we have a lot of capacity in the community. We have a great network of community-based preschools that have been in existence for a very long time. Many of them would like to expand, but they'll often say the issue is right now they only provide services to parents who can pay. And that's an issue. They often are having requests from families. I know, is there financial assistance? Are there subsidies? We would like to come to your school, but we just simply can't afford it.
At some point, though, a pretty sizable bump is going to have to be added to the state budget, no matter what the mechanism, correct?
It is, but the projections are that if we were at our goal of serving 85% of our kids with the public-private partnership, if question four passes mm-hmm. and people vote yes, the projected costs are between $40 and $50 million a year to serve all those children. Because, again, there would be cost sharing. Parents would help pay, county, federal money, et cetera. If we have to build the system only within the state has projected that the operating costs would be at least $125 million a year. And then on top of that, there's facilities, which is even more substantial perhaps. There's not enough classrooms and things. So again, we're looking at what's cheaper, what involves cost sharing, how we have those key public-private partnerships. But we're prohibited right now from doing that because of the Constitution. So
this ends the prohibition.
This would end that prohibition. And then it just opens up options on the table for the next legislature, for the next governor, to say, what do we want to do? Is it expand Head Start? Is it subsidies and contracts, and in which communities, and who would manage them? So it's leaving those options on the table and opening up those windows to make sure our kids can get the quality education they need.
Is it sometimes difficult, Deb, to sell government on something that has a long-term benefit rather than a short-term benefit? You know, the kids will have a much better life 15, 20 years from now if you educate the four-year-olds now.
Well, and I think that's why we're pushing the community to say this is important. I think 40 other states are doing this, mm-hmm. Including, you know, Oklahoma is one that we look at that's at the forefront. Oklahoma has 80% of their four-year-olds in pre-K right now. They know that investing is going to change the trajectory for that state. We have a lot of partners from the business sector, the Business Roundtable and the Chamber of Commerce who get it. And they say, we need to do this. If we want to have a better educated workforce down the line, if we want to help families today, if we want our kids ready and we want to see better outcomes, we have to do it. We have to invest at some point. So we'll keep pushing from the community side to say we need to find the resources. If we don't, I think we're looking at some dire consequences down the line.
And once pressure from the community side obviously has the intended effect in insufficient numbers. So good luck to you.
Thank you. Well, parents know it, right? I think that's what we hear out in the community. Parents saying, I need this. So I want to send my kid to pre-K and I need help.
That's a pretty powerful source, too.
Thank you.
Thanks, Deb. Deborah Zeisman is the executive director of the Good Beginnings Alliance. The Alliance and the Children's Action Network are coordinating the campaign for Vote Yes on 4, Pre-K for Keiki, an effort to pass ballot question number 4 on this November's general election ballot. Passage would amend our state constitution to allow the legislature to contract with community preschools to offer preschool to 4-year-olds in Hawaii. And details are at hpr2.org. Thank you. the show for our backyard quiz, we focused on improv in Hawaii in honor of the upcoming 9th annual Improvaganza Hawaii Festival of Improv. Lou Screws, a long-running but now disbanded theater group from Honolulu, has put on a wide range of shows, such as the sci-fi theme Spaced and the Power Rangers-inspired J-pop show Harajuku All-Girl Ninja Force. To many fans, the group is most celebrated for its one-of-a-kind improvised kabuki performance, Screwbuki. Though the format is always lighthearted and comedic, the performance uses traditional movements, vocal styling, combat, and music to create an entirely improvised kabuki play. Originally performed in 2000, Screwbuki garnered national attention and was eventually invited to perform at a prestigious improv festival on the mainland. For today's backyard quiz, we ask you to name this mainland improv festival, and the answer is the Chicago Improvisational Festival. It's 8:48, and that's today's quiz. If you have one of your own, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Good morning. I'm Victoria Gale White from Manoa Valley Theater. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Artist Sally Lundberg says history, culture, place, and belonging are important themes to her work, and she has a variety of ways to express them. She is a Hawaii Island-based multimedia artist here on Oahu to take part in a unique arts residency project called Present. It's aimed at creating a kind of educational nest for young artists, and she has very generously joined us this morning to tell us more about this exciting endeavor. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning, Lynn. How are you this morning?
I'm good. So you're here with your family, which I find most interesting. You're a family of artists, and your family is participating in this project as well as helping to lead it, right?
Yeah, we call ourselves Le Filter Feeders. We're kind of interested in this idea of aquatic feeding, which sort of is simply kind of taking in the sort of environment around you, and that's kind of how we make our art.
So tell me about the Present Project Nest. What is it exactly?
Well, Present Project itself is a 5-week artist residency, and we have 5 total artists that are international in scope. And also an education designer who will be doing an educational component with a large group of children, and they're creating a project called Nest. So it's kind of, there's kind of several dimensions to Present.
And where is this happening?
It's happening in 2 5,000-foot square warehouses in Kaka'ako. So 10,000 square feet. It's large. It's a wonderful opportunity.
So the children that are involved in this, under the supervision of the artists or with the artists, are building a nest. That is the project, an artistic nest, kind of. Tell me what will come out of this.
Okay, well, that's Nest is one part mm-hmm. of the project. Brian Welch is an education designer from New York, and he's here to kind of facilitate collaboration and experiences with the artists. The artists that are here are Caledoni Curry from New York, also known as Swoon, Denora De Jesus Rodriguez from Miami, Florence Carbon from Toulouse, France, and myself and my husband Keith Tallett from the Big Island. So we're doing our own individual projects in different parts of the warehouses, and then Brian is working with the kids twice a week, and they come in, and so they're doing several things. One of them is interact with the artists. As kind of appropriate in doing different little projects. And then they're also building this alternative bamboo structure. So he has like half the warehouse filled with these giant pieces of bamboo. And the kids have been building kind of miniature sculptural versions of what they think they'd like to build. And so sort of slowly things are starting to go up. And it's really exciting because I get kind of an inside view because our daughter, our 10-year-old daughter, Kia'i, is here with us. And so she's she's actually able to be there all the time. She's here with us for the duration of the 5 weeks. So she's kind of been over there doing almost the mini mock versions before the actual classes.
Okay, so the Nest is just one part of the artistic experience.
Yes.
And it started on the 3rd, just last week, Thursday, for 5 weeks. So how's it going so far? What's the energy like?
Well, the amazing thing about a residency, I think, that's different from simply having a show is in the case of a show, we would be in our studios making the artwork, preparing it, just coming here and putting it up.
And people just watch.
And people see the final product. But this is a 5 week kind of almost like a gestation period where we can come, we can, I know in our case, react to the environment around us, react to the space, to the community. And so the piece is kind of growing and changing as we experience. So we don't exactly know what, I know that Keith and I are doing an installation, but it is changing. So it's in process and it will be in process until the end. But people can come in and kind of, and check it out throughout the 5 weeks.
I noticed, I was reading, your husband is a tattoo artist, among other things.
Yeah, well.
So is his art that he's creating there in the form of a tattoo, or is it something else?
Well, Keith is a second-generation surfboard shaper. He learned from his dad. He's also a tattoo practitioner. He's also formally trained in painting and printmaking. I'm a documentary filmmaker and a photographer, but I'm inspired by kind of do-it-yourself survivalist and process art in my studio work. So we've been practicing individually for the past 20 years, but we've been together. So in the last number of years, we've kind of started to come together and collaborate. And so our work really can take form in sculpture, installation, painting, photography, and video. Mm-hmm. So the piece that we're working on here is going to be sculptural installation, and there will be photography. Tattooing. He has his tattoo gun with him. It may come into play.
You'll have to come down and find out. So we were talking a few minutes earlier about the preschool issue, preschool education. I don't know if you could hear any of that interview, but why do you think art is important at an early age? I mean, you've got children 10 to 14 who are participating in this. Why is it important for children, do you think?
You know, I think people are scared of art sometimes. I think adults are scared of art. Kids are not scared of art. So I think adults can be actually more inspired sometimes by the work that kids do. Kids come in, they're totally open. They're just ready to engage with whatever you put in front of them. And so for adults to kind of, it almost becomes like a segue for adults in the community to come in. They're less scared when they see kids doing it. And it kind of segues them into what the rest of us are doing.
Great explanation. I never thought of it that way, looked at it that way. What else would you like to leave our viewers with in our remaining seconds on the air?
Oh, I just really invite everyone to go to the website, which is presentproject.org. It lists all the ways that the community can get involved. On Wednesday, tomorrow night, Denora Rodriguez and Florence are presenting their work at Agora in Kaka'ako at 6:30, I believe. And, they're amazing. They are amazing. And this is an opportunity for Hawaii to really get a glimpse of international artists. This is a wonderful opportunity, not only for Keith and myself as Hawaii artists to interact, but for the community at large. So I really invite people to just come and check it out.
Sounds terrific. Thanks for taking the time to come down and share it with us this morning. And good luck with the rest of the residency.
Thank you.
Sally Lundberg is an interdisciplinary artist who lives and works on the Big Island, creating installations, sculpture, mixed media panels, videos, and films. The Nest workshop sessions run 3 to 5 p.m. Wednesdays and Fridays, continuing through October 3rd at the Cook Street Warehouses. You can learn more about the project at hpr2.org.
Hi, this is Chris Vandercook, co-host of The Conversation. Einstein said the important thing is not to stop questioning. And every weekday morning I get to question and learn from people across our state. Einstein is our inspiration for next month's fun drive, and we're celebrating his spirit of fierce individuality. But it doesn't take a genius to know that early gifts mean a shorter pledge drive. So please donate in advance. That'll be brilliant. Who was that?
Some interloper crashed the studio.
Lynn, we had a couple of stories that talked about how the mind works when you're young, you know, funding preschool, stimulating young artists, and there's this thing that happens when you're a child that you really want to keep alive throughout life.
You do, because I think it will help when you're older, as we talked about the senior years and keeping them rich and full.
Yeah, I'm enjoying the return to childhood myself. Well, that's it for today. Up tomorrow, an evening of spoken word and song from the producers of Aloha Shorts.
Plus, Valerie Chang joins us to talk about COPD Education Day.
If you have something to say, post it on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or on Twitter, HI Conversation, or at BKOZHPR. If you're a bit more private, email works too, and that's talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Past shows, links to more information about guests and topics, and lots of other good stuff on our website, hpr2.org. I'm Lynn Waters.
I'm Chris Vandercook. Meet us in the morning for more of the conversation.
Aloha.